Zechariah chapter 14. And our theme this evening is the holiness of heaven. The holiness of heaven. In chapters 12 and 13, there has been prophecy concerning Christ's redeeming work and its application, especially among Israel of after the flesh. And this chapter, though difficult, appears to be setting before us in Old Testament terminology the description of the church in the New Testament, and especially in the glorified state in heaven. First of all, consider affliction and deliverance. Affliction and deliverance from verse 1 to partway through verse 5. In verse 1 we read, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the house is rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle." In the first two verses, there is a picture of Jerusalem being taken by all nations, just as Babylon had taken Jerusalem in the past. But not all are destroyed. So in the second half of verse 2, "And half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city." But then in verse 3, down into part of verse 5, we have a description of the Lord's deliverance. Verse 4, "And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north, and half of it toward the south." This is the Lord's deliverance, and he is pictured as a man standing on the Mount of Olives, because from this point would be the best view of Jerusalem. And by his power, he is represented as cleaving in two the mount and coming for the deliverance of his people. That's the basic imagery here. The Lord standing on the Mount of Olives, cleaving the mountain, and providing a way of escape. So verse 5, "And ye shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Israel. Yea, ye shall flee like as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah king of Judah." And this earthquake in the days of Uzziah is only mentioned one other place. That's in Amos chapter 1 and verse 1. But here then is a representation of the Lord coming for the deliverance of his people, because the city has been ravaged by the enemy and deliverance now comes. Now some take this as the same basic picture as the references to Gog and Magog in Ezekiel 38 and 39 and in Revelation 20 verse 7 to 9. But those particular places represent the final assault of the powers of darkness upon the church before the coming of the Lord. However, in these passages, that is in Ezekiel and Revelation, the enemy merely encompasses the city, and the Lord comes in deliverance before the attack. But here, rather, we have perhaps not the final conflict, but rather a characteristic of the church in the New Testament all through, that throughout the centuries God has been afflicting his church, especially by means of the ungodly, for the perfecting and purifying of his church. And as he in the Old Testament, for example, used Babylon for the purifying of his church, So all through the history of the church, he sends affliction by means of the church's enemies, represented by the devastation of Jerusalem, and yet he always preserves a people. His people are not blotted out, as the enemy would desire, but he provides wonderfully for the preservation of a people to glorify his name in the earth. Hence, the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. And the Lord coming, as pictured by this standing upon the Mount of Olives, the Lord coming for the deliverance of his church, represented by Jerusalem in its devastation. So the safest view of the passage is simply to regard this as a steady feature, more or less, of the church's experience in this world of affliction and deliverance. But then secondly, dusk followed by noonday. Dusk followed by noonday. At the end of verse 5 we have, "And the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee. And it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night. But it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. And it shall be in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and in winter shall it be." We've called this dusk followed by noonday because it sets forth the future change of the church. Now, the church of the New Testament was, and the glorified church in heaven, was all future from the standpoint of the prophets. That is to say, Christ's first coming, the application of redemption, the conflict of the church in this world in the New Testament age, the advance of the gospel, the return of Christ, and the glorified state, the eternal state beyond, was all future in from the standpoint of the Old Testament prophet. And so what we have here is a setting forth of, in the first 5 verses, the norm of conflict in this world for the Church of God, and here the transition beyond that to the perfected state of the Church of God. And so first we have the Lord coming with his saints at the end of verse 5, "And the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee." That is to say, this scene of trial and conflict for the Church of God will not continue indefinitely, although there is ebb and flow and times when the gospel is at a low ebb and times when it advances, and we believe it will advance greatly in the earth. Yet in this world the church's existence is one of conflict, and yet this will not continue indefinitely. The Lord will come with his saints, or holy ones, referring to the holy angels as well as the perfected saints of God. And the prophet by the Spirit looks up from this scene characterizing the church below to the ultimate deliverance and victory at the coming of the Lord. And so the imperfect state of the church will give way to perfection at the coming of Christ. Verses 6 and 7. Now, these verses are difficult even to translate, never mind interpret. You can see that from the marginal notes. If you have a Bible with numbers indicating other ways of translating in the margin, verse 6 has 3 points at which the translators give alternative ways of rendering it in the margin. It is difficult, a difficult passage to translate. But the idea appears to be this, that verse 6 is describing what we would call the dusk, the twilight. That is, that the light shall not be clear nor dark. It's something in between. It's a dusk. But this is followed not by darkness, but by light. Verse 7. But it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night. But it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. In other words, this dusk, this twilight, is replaced by permanent light, not day nor night in the sense of a limited period, but by light. At evening time it shall be light. It's the idea of continuous light. So it's dusk followed by permanent light. And this is indicating that the final coming of the Lord in deliverance will bring in the everlasting day, the perfecting of the church in glory. And the perfected blessedness is symbolized as a stream flowing east and west, unaffected by the seasons. Verse 8. And it shall be in that day that living water shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea or eastern sea, and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and in winter shall it be. Now that's putting in terms that we can understand the idea of eternal life, of a flowing river in both directions, unaffected by seasonal changes. So this is speaking then of the transition from the imperfect state of the church militant on earth in its conflicts, to the perfected state of life eternal. Thirdly, the church's eternal day. The church's eternal day, from verse 9 to the end of the chapter. These verses are describing the future perfection of the church, the eternal state of the church. And the inspired writer is doing so in terms of Old Testament geography and symbolism. First of all, the unity of the church, verse 9. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall there be one Lord, and his name one. The church will be perfectly united in the Lord. The true religion shall be the only one upon the earth. This is looking forward to the new heavens and the new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. His name one, the only one, exclusively and unitedly acknowledged as the Lord, as the true and living God. There is no dispute among the godly, and there is no false religion of the ungodly. So the unity of the church, then the peace of the church, verse 10. All the land shall be turned as a plain from Geba to Rimon, south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place, from Benjamin's gate unto the place of the first gate, unto the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananiel unto the king's wine presses, and men shall dwell in it, and there shall be no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. Geba and Rimon, the northern and southern limits of Judah, will be a plain, no more mountains exalted above Jerusalem, no more vantage points for the enemy, nor pride of the enemy. And Benjamin's gate and the other references to the place of the first gate, the corner gate, the tower of Hananiel under the king's wine presses, these are the boundaries of the city, often ravaged before, but now no sign of trouble. Peace. And this is indicating the peace, the safety, but then the church was always safe. But the peace, the manifest safety of the church of God in its final state. Then we have the separateness of the church in verse 12 to the end. First of all, the cutting off and eternal punishment of the ungodly in verse 12 to 15. The ungodly in their sufferings are described in verse 12. And this shall be the plague wherewith the Lord will smite all the people that have fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand upon their feet, and their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongue shall consume away in their mouth. This is representing the sufferings of the damned, the eternal death of the damned, in terms of physical death. The language of physical death is here. And they shall go forth and look upon the carcasses of the men that have transgressed against them, for their worm shall not die, neither shall their fire be quenched. Eternal damnation of the ungodly, the wages of sin being meted out to them, is represented in terms of the corruption of the body at physical death, because that also is a consequence of sin, albeit a harbinger of eternal death. And so the eternal death of hell is pictured in terms of physical death and decay, but the pains of hell, of course, will afflict body and soul, and the body of the damned after the resurrection will not decay, but will be fitted for destruction. It will be, there shall be a resurrection unto damnation and to shame and everlasting contempt, and so their body shall be fitted to bear the wrath of God forever, which the present body is not. We know virtually nothing of the resurrection body of the damned, even less than the glorious body, resurrection body of the redeemed. But we do know that it shall be fitted to bear the wrath of God forever. But here that eternal judgment is set forth in terms of the first death, physical death, and so the description of the flesh consuming away and the eyes consuming away in their holes, and the tongue consuming away in the mouth. Then disunity, verse 13, and it shall come to pass in that day that a great tumult from the Lord shall be among them, and they shall lay hold every one on the hand of his neighbor, and his hand shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor. The damned will not be united by sharing a common ruin, and this verse indicates this. Rather, the opposite will be the case. There will be no harmony in hell of any kind. There will be no unity, even though all are wicked and all are damned. Yet there will be no harmony, because sin does not produce harmony. And so that there will be no consolation in hell for the inhabitants of hell. They will find no comfort in the fact that others are with them in their same lost condition. It will not console them, not in any measure whatsoever. Hell is a place full of hatred. Even the restraints of natural affection will be removed in hell. If men can be without, implacable and without natural affection on earth, how much more in the eternal state of condemnation. Earthly relationships outside of Christ will not last. Men and women particularly may romantically pledge themselves to eternal love, but it's a falsehood. There will be no love in hell. That malice which only occasionally flared up and flashed to the surface in this world will be a settled norm in this lost condition. That's why it's so foolish when men with an ungodly and blasphemous bravado, when you speak of hell, they say, oh, well, there'll be plenty more of us, but it will afford no consolation. Just as the lost will draw no comfort from God or from holy angels or from redeemed men, yet neither will they find consolation in their fellow damned sinners. And it is this internal disharmony that is pictured in verse 13, the idea of internal hatred and variance. But then there is the deprivation of former blessings. They will be deprived of former blessings. Verse 14, and Judah also shall fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the heathen round about shall be gathered together, gold and silver and apparel in great abundance. Here again, in Old Testament language, we have a picture of Judah and Jerusalem, the church of God, having triumphed over all their enemies, taking all the blessings of the ungodly, of the nation, as victors through Christ, like the talent taken from the unfaithful servant and given to the one with 10 talents. So also the blessings that even the ungodly have enjoyed in this world will be taken away from them. Their portion in the goods of the earth will be taken from them. And all blessings amongst men will belong to the people of God. They will be blessed. And the ungodly will be damned. All the abused blessings of reprobate men will now be gone. Then we have a curse-filled existence, verse 15. And so shall be the plague of the horse, of the mule, of the camel, and of the ass, and of all the beasts that shall be in these tents as this plague. Here, pictured in terms of the effects of the curse in the present life, we have a representation of how life for unsaved sinners in the world to come will be a curse-filled existence. The curse of God upon sin, which blighted earthly existence, and speaking of the plague of the horse, the mule, and so on, that's simply representing the curse of God in the next world in terms of the effects of the curse in the present. And all of existence in hell will be filled with the curse of God. There will be no escape in anything from that curse, from the displeasure, the wrath of God. Even their former friendships are now a curse and a burden. So there is separateness, because there will be this cutting off of the ungodly and their eternal punishment. But secondly, the people of God will be united in the worship of God. Verse 16 to 19. Verse 16. And it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whoso will not come up of all the families of the earth unto Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. And if the family of Egypt go not up and come not, but have no rain, there shall be the plague wherewith the Lord will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt, and the punishment of all nations that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles was that most joyful of feasts, looking back to the wilderness journey and also rejoicing in the harvest. And that most joyful of festivals is here used as a symbol for the joyful worship of God. There are those who try to apply this literally, and of course the result is absurdity. This cannot all be applied literally in a consistent manner. Rather, the Feast of Tabernacles represents the joyful worship of God in which all the redeemed of the nations shall join. And then in verse 17 to desire for it. These are the ungodly, and no rain is given to them. But then in verse 18, as if to show how the Lord never lacks means to judge, it takes the example of Egypt, who didn't really rely on the rain because they had the river Nile, but the plague would come upon them. In other words, this is telling us, in by using Old Testament history and its language, it's telling us that those who have no desire for the worship of the Lord, those who are not prepared for heaven, will be separated, and God will not lack means to judge them. And the idea of rain not falling on a particular place is showing the exactness of the division, the distinction that God will make between those who fear Him and those who fear Him not. There will, it's not saying that there will be a mixture in the eternal world of the godly and the ungodly. It's saying rather that the true people of God will unite in the worship of God with joy, whereas those who have no love to God and no worship in them, they will be cast out and will be judged in eternal damnation. And then we have the perfect holiness of the church. You understand that these things are representing truths concerning the eternal world set forth in terms of Old Testament history and this present life. But so they are not to be taken literally, they are setting forth truths concerning the eternal state. And so thirdly, we have the perfected holiness of the church, verse 20. In that day shall there be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord, and the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts, and all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and feed therein. And in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. The bells or bridles of the horses, the smallest items, shall bear the name holiness unto the Lord. In the Old Testament, the ceremonial distinction between those items that were holy to the Lord, consecrated to the Lord, and what was not consecrated to the Lord, that distinction was to show the difference that God made between holy and unclean. That ceremonial distinction existed on account of sin. But here in the heavenly realm, there is no distinction. And that's the picture here, that even the bells on the horses, using the language of the present state of things, it's as if even the bells on the horses are holy to the Lord. There is no distinction between clean and unclean. It's telling us that the ultimate state of the church will be one where all is purity, all is holiness. And so it goes on, and the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Those bowls before the altar dedicated to the Lord, the other bowls, the ash pans, and so on. They will be like the bulls before the altar. In fact, verse 21, yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. This is just telling us in ceremonial language that whereas there was a distinction, the bulls, the golden bulls at the altar, compared with the other bulls and utensils in the house of the Lord, compared with every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah, all those distinctions between holy to the Lord and that which was common and unclean have gone, because all is holiness. In other words, there is no distinction between clean and unclean, because all is clean, all is pure, all is glorifying to God. And so it's using the language of the ceremonial distinction between clean and unclean and the abolition of that to say that in this perfected state, everything is holiness. And this is confirmed in that day, there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. The Canaanite, the alien, the non-Christian. No, they're not there. Only the true people of God. The church is perfected. It is no longer subject to mixture. The redeemed are no longer imperfect saints. And there are only saints in the church now, in its perfected state. This is telling us then that the whole life of heaven, in all that we do in that glorified state of the church, will be one of perfect devotion to the Lord with no mixture at all. There will be no unholiness in heaven. Nothing that defileth shall in any wise enter therein. And there will be no imperfection in the saints. How different from this present life, where all our devotion to the Lord is dogged and by sin, which doth so easily beset us. It's clogged and marred, and it falls short. But there will be an end to that conflict, that flesh lusting against the spirit. There will be an eternal end, and the people of God will be all holiness unto the Lord. There will be no envy in heaven. There will be no disagreement, no disputing. There will be none of that malice that creeps in the thinking of the people of God. None of that selfishness, none of that pride, none of that vanity. But all will be holiness. We can apply this in at least two ways. First, true Christians desire not only the happiness of heaven, but the holiness of it, which is of the essence of the happiness. Why is heaven a happy place? It is a happy place because Christ is there and sin is not. And true Christians, they long to be with Christ, they long to be like Christ. They long for both the holiness and the happiness of heaven. All men want to be happy, but they seek happiness in that which can never give happiness, that is sin and enmity with God. But they want to be happy without being holy, and it can never be. But true Christians, yes, they want to be happy, but they want to be holy, and they shall be. They shall be both to perfection. Then consider, secondly, that the joy in God and the holy devotion of the heart towards holiness that we have in heaven which we shall have in heaven, the joy in God and the holy devotion to God of the heavenly state, will forever exceed our highest spiritual joys and holy longings in this world. The truth of the matter is that our spiritual life fluctuates. Hopefully it fluctuates upwards on the whole, but it fluctuates. There are times when we feel an ardent joy and longing after God and after his Christ and conformity to his will. But then another time when we sluggish and half-hearted and relatively unconcerned about holiness. We fluctuate. But in heaven, there will be no fluctuation. And our joys in God and our holiness and our devotion to God will exceed anything that we have ever known. Our most blessed moments of communion with Christ in this world are but a foretaste. An imperfect foretaste. We will exceed all that we have known in this world, and that without interruption and without end. To be in Christ now is glorious, but to be with him and to be like him and to see him as he is. No more sin, no more contradiction. Here in this world, we bemoan our contradictions. We contradict the very truth, the very doctrines, the very principles of the Word of God that we hold precious. We contradict them. We condemn the sins of the world, and yet, in a measure, we go along with them. But not them. Compromises all gone, and the trials of faith will have gone, because faith will have given way to sight and perfect holiness in seeing him. In heaven we shall never doubt that it was worth following Christ on earth. In heaven we shall never for a moment think that it mightn't have been best to have followed Christ. Here in our unbelief we wonder sometimes, sinfully we wonder, is it worth it? Of course it's worth it. In heaven we'll know forever that it was worth it. Let us then possess our souls in patience, gird up the loins of our minds, hope to the end, pursue holiness, till we are bidden by the Redeemer, enter thou into the joy of thy Lord.